Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins, and here in one of the beautiful, very well-appointed client meeting rooms in 440 Strand, we're also joined by a very special guest this week. It's Coutts Head of FX Sales and Trading, Ray Monahan. I hope I've got that right because I often get your name wrong, Ray. I'm very sorry about that. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things investors need to know for the week ahead. But before we get onto the subject of the world of Forex with Ray, Alan, you've got a couple of quick things you wanted to say about some data we've had out this week.
Yes. So normally we would do three things in the market. So just a little bit of a taste. So we've had US inflation. It was exactly in line. So what did markets do? I'm talking about risk markets, primarily equities, of course, rally. That's the way markets are at the moment. We'll come to that. In contrast, in the UK, we had jobs data accompanied by wages data. Remarkably, the UK economy seems to be very strong. One, two, wages data strong, inflationary, mini, I'm not going to call it a crisis yet, but a mini upheaval, especially at the short end of the bond market. You're probably hearing all about mortgages. Yeah. So you better set me some homework for next week's Need to Know.
I think, yeah, you're going to do some research into poor bond markets, was that
poor markets in the UK? What exactly is what are the theories of why UK is suffering on inflation?
Yeah.
The various theories out there. Yeah. Feel free to contact me on alan.higgins@coutts.com if you've got any. I'll read as much of the research as I can, summarize it, and then give our own view.
Okay. And also, I think, but we'll probably pick this up next week, you found another bull, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it was so hard to find a bull. Goldman Sachs has become bullish. So hopefully we'll have an interesting one next week.
Yeah.
So yeah, a few people are throwing in the towel and saying, okay, you've got to go with equities.
Okay. All right then. Well, we'll pick that up next week. But I know, Alan, you're going to be sort of chipping in with some thoughts later on. So Ray, thank you very much for joining us for this special episode of Need to Know. Now, I guess before we sort of talk about what's happening in markets at the moment and the outlook for the year ahead, I think it'd be really interesting to start with your experience in Forex, because you've been doing this for a very long time. How did you get started? When did you get started?
I'm showing my age now. Like everything else, it starts in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
I ended up doing economics and politics MA at Glasgow University. Then 85, 86, I did a master's degree in economics and government at London School of Economics. Was looking for a job in a bank.
Yeah.
Applied for a job as an economist. They didn't give me the job as an economist at one of the Australian clearing banks. They said, called me up and said, would you like to be a bond trader? Mm. And I didn't know whether it was Basild and Bond, Root Bond, or James Bond. I ended up being a bond trader back in the 1987, trading warrants and zero coupon bonds and things like that. And then one day I picked up a call because we were in a new dealing room merged with the trading desk.
Mm.
And they said, oh, you look as if you've got an aptitude for currency. And they said, do you want to join the currency desk? And that was the start of a 35 years in foreign exchange. I worked for various clearing banks and investment banks like Commonwealth Bank of Australia, Deutsche Bank, UniCredit, and now Coutts. So here I am.
So you talked about an aptitude. What was it? What is that aptitude that makes you good as a currency trader?
I was thinking about this last night in advance of this. And it might sound a bit of a cliche, but what you do need as a currency trader, particularly back in the 90s and early 2000s, one, mental resilience.
Okay.
Because you have to come back. Everyone's going to have bad days and lose money. It doesn't matter if you're the best trader in the world. The best trader in the world's batting average or win ratio is normally about 7, 7.5 out of 10.
Right.
So number one, you need mental resilience to come back after a bad day when you've actually called the market wrong, whether it's proprietary trading or market making. Also think you need mental agility. You need to be able to think on your feet. You also need to be able to change your mind and understand when you're wrong. You also need discipline. I mean, I know it's a much used phrase, but John Maynard Keynes got it right. The market can be irrational far longer than you can say solvent. The amount of stubborn traders I've seen who think they can second guess the market when they're the wrong side of it. So you must have discipline. You must stick to a stop loss. And lastly, fourthly, I would say you need some sort of medium-term perspective if you like a trend, whether it's the appreciation of the dollar, late '80s, mid '90s appreciation of the dollar last year. Whether it's, as Alan mentioned earlier, are we in a risk-on or a risk-off sentiment market? You need to be able to have a wider perspective, an understanding of macroeconomics and an understanding of what influences currency markets. So you need a mixture of everything, mental resilience and agility, a wider macroeconomic view and discipline. You must have discipline.
Okay. So just picking out one of the terms you used there, because there's going to be probably some language that certainly I'm not that familiar with and probably some listeners may not know. Market maker, explain what you mean by that from a currency perspective.
In the mid-early 90s to, say, the early 2000s, there were not as many online trading platforms. There was not as much transparency in markets. Nowadays, you can log on to your iPhone, your PC, and you'll see where the interbank rate and sterling against the dollar, dollar yen, dollar Swiss is. A market maker is someone who makes a market. It shows you a bid and it shows you an offer.
Right.
So if you're a hedge fund, you're calling me, I'm working at a big bank, an investment bank, which was the case, and you say to me, I want a price in 20 million sterling against the dollar, 50 million. You would show a bid and an offer.
You'd have so to bring that live, let's jump in. Today, sterling dollar is 126.30. Because I do think it's the most incredible job, Sarah. It's the purest job, you know, me being more of a generalist everywhere. Because credit to Ray, in those days, you had to make a two-way price and somebody could either sell you sterling or buy sterling off you. So if today sterling's 126.3, what market would you be kind of forced to make? And how much risk would you therefore have to take to this hedge fund or investment manager?
It would depend on the size. But a normal spread back in those days would be 3 pips or 5 pips round the market. So the market sterling today is trading at 126.30. You want to make a two-sided price, you would make 126.28.33.
Okay.
Because you would think the person is a buyer, so you would shade it slightly.
But that seems insanely tight bid offer spread now even, and even then. I mean, you mentioned resilience because there must be times when markets are moving quickly that you make a market, someone trades with you, you almost immediately are losing money.
You're immediately out of court, but that's where the mental agility comes in. You have to decide, is that person, does he, she know something?
Okay.
7 times out of 10, they probably do.
Yeah.
You can lose money on the initial, what they call cover trade, cover your position, i.e. buy that 20, 30 million sterling back in,
and
buy some more because you think that person knows what way it's going, is dealing with other people, is moving the market, knows there's some positive sterling news coming out. So that's where the mental agility comes in. Or you decide, no, my view is sterling's going down. I will, what they used to say, I will sit on that position.
Yeah.
It's a long day. In those days, you were in the trading room, actively trading, taking over the books from Singapore, Tokyo, Hong Kong at 7 o'clock in the morning in London. And you would hand the book over to your colleague in the investment bank in New York at 4 o'clock. So it was a long day. So there was loads of fluctuation, loads of changes. So you have an intraday market maker who makes a price to hedge funds, corporates, private individuals, whatever, clients across the board. And then you have the proprietary side of it. You might say to yourself, I'm going to take a longer view. I'm going to run this position for a week or so, which is back to what I mentioned earlier. An important thing is to almost divorce your intraday trading from proprietary trading in those days and have a longer term perspective.
So did you do both, Ray? Did you do both proprietary? So proprietary is more like what we do as a fund manager, take positions, or were you forced to even cover your position at the end of the day?
No, you weren't. Everyone had you. And it's genuinely, it's less so the case now. You would run an intraday book. Mm-hmm. A lot of my career was trading currencies such as Aussie, Kiwi, Canada. You would have your not run-of-the-mill intraday business where you would hope to make a margin, run a position. And if you had a strong view of what was happening, if there was data coming out overnight in Japan and late afternoon in the States and Asia, you would have a limit overnight. So someone would say you can have a position overnight to whatever, 10, 20, 30, depending on what your role was.
He needs millions, by the way.
Exactly.
So you were a mixture of both animals.
Yeah.
The market has changed so much now because things are so much more transparent.
Yeah.
As I said before, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, the only really transparent pricing was on the Reuters trading platform.
Okay.
Late 90s, early 2000s, we had things like EBS, which is a trading platform. Lots of banks set up their trading platforms, invited other liquidity providers who had interest in buying or selling at a specific rate to become what's called LPs, liquidity providers. Mm. Spreads are tighter now and there's less market making. And what you find now is that most people would declare their interest.
Okay.
The pure market making market is not as prevalent.
So prior to that, if you were giving someone a price, you didn't know if they were buying or selling.
No. So you, again, that's for the, as I mentioned earlier, the wider view.
Yeah.
You might deal with a corporate who you think is an exporter. What does an exporter get paid in? Dollars.
Yeah.
The person calls in, I want a price in 20, 30 million sterling against the dollar. Mm. Now, if he's an exporter and he's earning in dollars, 6 or 7 times out of 10, he's going to be selling those dollars to turn them back into sterling. So you would fractionally move the bid.
Okay.
So all those little nuances come into play.
Yeah. It's fair to say, Ray, in those times, because I used to be on the other side of the phone sometimes, it's competitive. You couldn't move your price that much, or the sales team would be enraged. But I think for our younger listeners who want to be traders, because I've done this a bit when I visited universities, and what attributes, as opposed to us sitting in fund management, okay, it's decision-making in fund management longer term, but to be traders, obviously you can't be slow. You have to be pretty quick. But what attributes, you mentioned mental resilience. If you get two or three factors that you really need to embrace if you want a career as a trader, whether you're trading Apple stock, foreign exchange, bonds, gold.
I'll tell you a funny story. My brother was a bookmaker.
Mm.
One of my brothers was a bookmaker and I worked in his bookmaker shop. My father worked in a bookmaker as well. So I helped out. So I was always quite good at mental arithmetic. Yeah. I know that sounds so basic, but you need to be good at mental arithmetic.
Yeah.
You must have a risk appetite.
As opposed to maths. Because it can be different.
You don't need to be good at higher maths unless you're an analyst.
Yeah.
But you do need to be good at mental arithmetic. Yeah. And you do need to be able to think quickly. And you do need to be not proud. And you do need to be that mental agility thing. And you must have a risk appetite.
Yeah.
You must not be terrified of money. It's what I always used to say when I was giving talks to graduates or employing people when I was running a spot desk at various banks, I'd say, it's only bananas.
Mm.
It's a commodity. Money is a commodity.
Yeah.
And not so much an asset, although people like to call it an asset. Money is a commodity.
Yeah.
Think of it in numbers terms, because if you think of it in millions, someone once said to me, you must treat it as your own money. Well, you don't, or else you wouldn't sleep at night, unless you are running your own hedge fund.
Yeah.
So back to that mental agility, you must decide what your risk appetite is. If you do not like risk and the reward at the end of it, it's the wrong job for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you must enjoy markets. You must enjoy the buzz.
Yeah.
And you must have a wider perspective in the world, because you must understand things like, you might say to a person, the oil price is dropping here. What currency is that going to impact? Well, it's going to impact Norwegian kroner. The gas price is moving. What currency is that going to impact? It's going to impact Aussie dollar, Canadian dollar. What happens if a market, Alan mentioned it earlier, markets went a bit risk on yesterday because US inflation data, and it looks as if the Fed are going to pause today.
Yeah.
What happens when a market goes at risk on? You have risk currencies, which are euro, sterling. Demand comes in for them.
Mm.
What happens when we have the financial crisis, whether it's 1998, Latin America, whether it's 2008, we have risk-off markets. Where do markets go when it's risk-off? They go to the dollar, they go to Swiss, and to a lesser extent, yen. So you must be well-read as well.
Yeah.
It does help to be well, have an appreciation of macroeconomics.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to say, you talked through there a few events and how that impacts currency. What, in your career as a trader, what was the biggest, most sort of tumultuous period or day in your trading career?
Well, I remember Soros and Black Wednesday and the exchange rate mechanism when the Chancellor and the government thought they could take on multiple hedge funds who had slightly deeper pockets and a longer time frame and didn't have to.
1992, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Norman Lamont famously singing about.
Exactly.
They say don't fight the Fed, but apparently you can fight the Bank of England, can't you?
sometimes central banks and governments have to pay attention to headlines.
Mm.
Hedge funds, corporate investors take a longer term view. 2008 was tumultuous. 2008 really was.
Financial crisis.
2008, we were sitting in dealing rooms thinking the world economy is going to blow up here. You know, certain politicians did very well to stabilise things at that time. And that's not taking a political view. The market's got too far ahead of themselves and the subprime market, whatever you want to call it. Whatever. There's loads of different views about it.
Mm.
But that was a almost scary time. I remember sitting in dealing rooms thinking how many banks are going to go bust here. And volatility was through the roof.
Mm.
And you had to have, I better be careful about saying it. You had to have certain nerves if you were running a book in those days. And that was 2008 was, I think people forget how tumultuous it was. You were thinking, who's the next bank here after
Wales? I was working at Morgan Stanley, Ray, and we were thinking we may not survive the weekend.
Yes.
And then just at Morgan Stanley, just say now super successful, a Japanese government bank, Mitsubishi, wrote a check, an old-fashioned check, which we waited for, which was a capital infusion. And then remember clearly, it was only when Tim Geithner, who was then
Treasury Secretary,
basically said, there'll be no more Lehman's.
Yeah.
Mm.
We realised, he's talking to us.
That was about
thank
like,
God. Thank yeah. God. But I'm with Ray.
It was about 2008. Yeah. 2008, and then the next one, like Geithner, would have been Mr. Draghi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who said,
whatever it takes.
We will do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
And he basically did. That was another scary time, the Greek debt crisis.
How many memos did we write about Greece together?
Yeah, exactly.
We were doing one a week.
Well, exactly.
You know.
That was another tumultuous time.
Okay.
Those two are imprinted.
But we need.
That's
sales.
History. Yeah.
I want to hear about it right now.
Before we move on to sort of forecasting what we think is going to be happening over the next sort of couple of months. But the difference then, because you're more now on the sales side, how is that different? What skill set do you need for that compared to the trading side of things?
I think you need to, it's more nuanced. On the sales side, as you know, and our listeners know, we speak to a huge variety of diverse variety of high net worth individuals, companies. You need to know your audience. It might be a commercial company, it might be a private equity partner, it might be someone who's sold their business, maybe someone who's not used to numbers, financial markets. You have to be a people person.
Okay.
And I love being a people person. I mean, I speak to such a diverse group now. And be nuanced and understand that, be empathetic to where that person, it could be a person who spent 20 years building up a business, a man and a woman who have just a family business, who have then sold it to a, you see a lot of US companies buying out British and European companies these days to basically get rid of the competition.
Mm.
And this is a pivotal moment in their life, so you must be empathetic towards the client.
Mm.
Then the next phone call might be a high net worth private equity chap who wants a quick conversation and move on.
Yeah,
You know, it might be a private equity man or woman who's just knows the business. So you must understand your market, whether it's a commercial client, finance client, sports and media.
Yeah, completely different.
And build that trust. I know it sounds a bit trite, but you have to build trust with your clients.
So I get that. And so just again for our graduates and people listening, so where does it go wrong in sales? I mean, I should say Ray and the team constantly get tremendous feedback for that sales service and execution, but you deal with a lot of people also in the salesperson, whether it sales business, either internally or externally. Where do you see it somewhat go wrong? What do you, any? So I get you empathize. Is it as simple as that? People don't empathize. People no. Is it as simple as that?
You have to be very careful as well. You must not tell clients what to do. You can give them a good overview, give them advice with a small a, but the decision must be theirs.
Yeah.
It goes wrong when people try to tell someone what to do. You can give, if a client decides, no, that's not for me, I want to wait a bit longer. And I would go back to something I said earlier. One thing I always, and I do agree with this, Peter Flavelle said something interesting 2 or 3 years ago, our chief executive, which stuck with me. We are here to preserve client wealth. and enhance it. So if I have a client, it can't be a commercial client, private individual, high net worth individual, whatever, who wants to try and second guess the market, that's where it can go wrong.
Yeah.
And I always push back against that.
Mm.
You know, our job is to give best execution, transparent, competitive pricing, and make sure the client's content and look after their wealth. Amateurs should not speculate.
Mm.
And always come back to a statistic from the Bank of England, only 16% of people make money on their own account trading currencies.
Goodness.
Trying to second guess the market.
Yeah.
If nothing else, keep that statistic in your mind when you're speaking to clients on your currency exposure.
Mm. Okay. Well,
so just on that, yeah. Sorry to keep jumping in, Sarah, over you, but that is especially right, correct me if I'm wrong, people who use leverage, we won't mention any names out there. Nothing wrong with leverage per se, but leverage in currency is so seductive because you can change in trading huge sizes, but it's obviously so difficult to get right.
Correct.
And that's why they do it. But
it seems to have great potential for gains, but I have seen many people lose money in the last 25 years thinking they can outlive the market or out second guess the market. If at all possible, unless you're a professional, unless it's your full-time job, don't speculate.
Yeah, okay. All right then. Well, that's sort of the career and the skills required. Let's focus now a little bit on sort of outlook. I mean, Alan, you've got some questions for Ray about where we are at the moment with
I want to go to that. I'm with this long career, and we mentioned absolutely speculation don't do.
Yeah,
but kind of longer term positioning, kind of what Coutts does and some others do. Is there anything, Ray, that works from your perspective? Is for our listeners, what works in FX, or is it honest enough to say really you shouldn't rely on anything?
I would still say the demise of the dollar has been grossly exaggerated.
Yeah,
and the demise of the US economy.
Yeah,
I mean, 10 years ago we were talking about, you know, or 15 years ago, I can remember. Everyone's saying, let's learn Mandarin and the Chinese economy is going to take over.
Yeah.
One thing I've never done is underestimate the strength of the US economy.
Okay, so that's something structural.
That's a
what
structural
about techniques? Long-term thing. Some people talk about interest rates. Some people talk about the trend. So right now, sterling's going up, so just buy it. This is not advice. Don't forget
the black exactly. No, I will remember the disclaimer at the end. Yeah.
I mean, so the theories I've seen are interest rates, and it's called momentum, follow the trend. What do you think of those two?
Last year was a classic example of momentum as in dollar strength. If you think about it, notwithstanding we had a lot of political flux in the UK, the dollar had this trend last year, which could be seen pretty much from the first quarter last year, was that of a strong dollar against all G20 currencies. Most successful traders, as I said earlier, can divorce themselves. They can do an intraday job, but have a proprietary position on a trend. So things like strong dollar trend, things like risk-off markets in 2008. Interest rates do play into it. People sometimes get too negative about rises in interest rates, but basic economics will tell you that interest rate differentials can be great drivers of currency strength as well.
Mm.
Why are we seeing that's one of the factors which is helping sterling at the moment?
Yeah.
The expectation that the Bank of England is going to keep raising rates for perhaps another full 1%.
Yeah.
That plays into it. Political, people always get excited about politics, or sometimes get excited about politics. Day-to-day political events do not have a huge impact on currency markets. Notwithstanding our little blow-up last September in the UK, something like the budget won't really move currency markets. You know, look for the longer trend, whether it's risk on or risk off markets, and look at those currencies. And commodity markets, keep an eye on commodity markets, keep an eye on gold. It's a mixture of everything. At the moment, just now, classic example, the Saudis are trying to prop up the oil price, but what's happening? Markets are pretty risk neutral at the moment. We're having little bouts of risk on. And markets are risk neutral. People are still worried about a recession in the latter half of this year. Then that oil price ain't going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, again, that feeds into currencies.
Okay. So you talked about last year saw this sort of dollar, strong dollar narrative. We've seen strong sterling. How do we see this playing out over the second half of this year? What's the view? What's your view at the moment on US dollar?
My view on sterling or the dollar?
Both.
Sterling at the moment is benefiting from a number of things. One, there's less political risk, whether it's Scottish referendum, whether it's EU-UK trade war. Things are a bit calmer than they were last year politically in this country, so there's those things in it. And I think we're now seeing some interest rate differential demand. Last year was abnormal. Cannot stress that enough. Sterling lost 20% against the dollar and reached a 37-year low last year of 104, 105. If I had a fiver for every time a client called me up and said, Ray, are we going to parity? I'd be hitting a golf ball with a sun on my back. That was absurd last year. Yeah. And I'm not surprised to see sterling rally this year. And a lot of people got too greedy last year looking to, a lot of clients with dollar income, dollar revenue, look to sell their dollars, buy sterling under 110. This year we've seen sterling appreciate 4% against the dollar, trading 126. NatWest Markets forecast, end of the year, 127, 130. I don't really disagree with that. 140 is too far away, i.e. Yeah. pre-Brexit levels. That's too far away. I don't see that happening. I think fair value just now is pretty much where we are, 126, 128. And also sterling's benefited against the euro. Most forecasters had sterling euro at 114, 116. We're a bit higher than that at the moment, 117. And that's because, surprisingly, most of the data out of the eurozone this year has been pretty sluggish. The German economy is underperforming. Industrial production numbers there. And I think the ECB might be reluctant to raise interest rates much more. So sterling is pretty stable at the moment. Forget the day-to-day political headlines. Sterling's pretty stable. And I think 126, 128 end of the year and 115, 117 sterling euro. And the dollar benefited last year for a number of factors, whether it was Ukraine, whether it was commodity markets. Yeah. That's almost in the background now. Commodity markets are pretty quiet. However obscene it might seem, that Ukraine is now not on the front pages and the shock there seems to have dissipated a little bit. So there's less risk off and therefore less dollar demand. So you've actually seen more stable currency markets.
Yeah, okay. I think, Alan, you've got one more.
Yeah, I've just stolen the pen. I just thought, Ray, sorry, I'm going to throw this at you. We're a broad church here at Coutts. You know what's coming? Is Bitcoin currency? In your view, your personal view, we're a broad church of believers, complete non-believers. What's your view on Bitcoin and other crypto?
I think it's a bit of an Indian rope trick. I want nothing to do. I want nothing to do with it. Right. I don't think it's not a fiat currency backed by any government or whatever. I've seen too many people lose too much money in it. It's not something I would want and be happy to promote to our clients, because the variation or the VAR in it, what we call variation at risk, basically volatility in it, can be ridiculous. And there's too much room for corruption in it, in my humble opinion. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe I'm too old fashioned, maybe I'm too old, I don't know, but it's not something I'm comfortable with, Bitcoin. And I follow it every day. I've read loads about it. Yeah, don't get me wrong. And the technology, the ledger technology, yeah, there's a usage for that.
Yeah, the blockchain.
Yeah, there is definitely a usage for that. But is it a product I want to promote? No. Is it a product I believe in? No. I always remember a story where you go in the world. If you turn up in Red Square 20 years ago, they didn't want rubles off you, they wanted dollars. And people want dollar, Swiss, yen, Her Majesty's or His Majesty's currency.
Yeah.
People don't want you to pay them in Bitcoin or run of the mill. Normal people don't.
Yeah. Okay. What about gold then? Is gold not a kind of a currency, a belief system?
Yeah.
Are you happy if we give you a gold bar for your services to this podcast, wouldn't you? So, you know, a physical Bitcoin?
Central banks are looking into Bitcoin because they have to look into it. There's talk about central bank backed Bitcoin. I might have a different view on it then. Gold looks a bit topish at the moment. Gold has its uses, and particularly in certain parts of the world.
as in China, Asia, very gold positive centres. Looks a bit toppish at the moment, just under $2,000 an ounce.
But it's a complete belief system.
It's a belief system because people believe there's a finite amount of gold. I suppose people believe there's a finite amount of Bitcoin, but I'm not so sure.
Also, I mean, gold has a tangible use as well, doesn't it, which Bitcoin doesn't have.
Bitcoin is not readily acceptable everywhere as a medium of exchange.
Mm.
We better leave Sarah to do that big compliance warning.
I think we'd better
Bitcoin
have thank you very much, Ray Monahan, for joining Alan and I today. It's fascinating. And I think the lesson that I take away from this is if you want to be a currency trader, you've got to be very smart. You've got to know your economics. You've got to understand your politics, and you've got to be very mentally tough and disciplined, and don't sort of and have a thick skin probably as well. Don't be too sensitive.
Got to wake up in the morning and go again if you've had a bad day. And trust me, that happens often.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that positive note, for anybody listening that's thinking about it, you know, reach out to us or Need to Know. And we'll put you in touch with Ray Moynihan if you want to have a chat with him. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan and Ray, for joining me today here in 440 in the Strand. So apologies if you've heard a few sort of clanking of teacups in the background. We're just sitting here having a very nice cup of Earl Grey whilst we're having our chat. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, Spotify and Google Podcasts. You can also access previous episodes, including last week's episode in which Alan had a bit of a rant about the FCA. So if anyone from the FCA is listening to that, you might want to listen to last week's Need to Know. That's all for this week. We may do an additional episode if everything kicks off, because we've got the Fed meeting this week, if we get any surprises from the Fed. But otherwise, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.